Hey everyone, good morning. A special shout out to all of you at Grace Church in Girard, in Harbor Creek, in the Commons, as well as to all those watching online. My name's Scott Michael, and I'm the site pastor here at our McCain location. And it's such a privilege to be with each of you today as we start our second week in our Hebrew series. You know, I had a mentor who would always remind me that to understand the content of something, I had to learn about the context that it occurred in first. And so in that spirit, to understand our text today, I need to take us back first to the time of ancient Israel. You see, we are in the heart of Jerusalem. We are standing in the outer courts of the temple itself. And there's a constant breeze blowing from the south gate. And we're making small talk in a group just to the left of the temple steps when there's a hush that seems to fall over the people in the courtyard. And the wave of silence puts pause in us as well, and we turn to see what the cause of the sudden silence is all about. And we are all taken aback to see it's him, the mediator of God on our behalf, in all of his spiritual radiance, adorned with a distinguished dignity befitting that of a high priest. You see, take a look at him. He's donning this linen tunic as the foundation of all his priestly garments. And over this was a robe of blue, hemmed at the bottom with these ornate pomegranates woven from blue, purple, and scarlet yarn. And they were placed intermittently between these small golden bells that rang musically with every step. There was this richly woven multicolored sash that held the robe in place. And there was an apron ephod, which was worn over the robe, which was adorned with gold threads that was woven with finely twisted linen of blue, purple, and scarlet yarns. And on top of each of his shoulders bore these large onyx stones that was set in gold. And the names of the 12 tribes were engraved on each stone, 6 on one stone, 6 on the other, in order of birth. And fastened to the front of the ephod by golden chains was the breastplate, a 9-inch square tapestry of gold, blue, purple, and scarlet linen that bore 4 rows of 3 jewels, each engraved with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Lastly, he was crowned with a turban of fine linen, bearing a plate of gold with the inscription, "Holy to the Lord." Can you imagine the sight when the sunlight hit as he approached the steps of the temple? The jewels illuminated in their full color over his heart, and the sound of those angelic bells as he strode forward, bearing the weight of Israel on their shoulders as he went to atone for their sins. Man, what a sight he had to be. I just imagine when he walked by, people just stopped and stared, or better yet, bowed their heads in profound respect, reverence, and admiration, because this man was a man of God, set apart for the highest honor in Israel. What a source of confidence he had to be for them. Confidence because they knew he was appointed by God. Confidence because he was like them in all ways, human and full of sin nature, who kept going to God on their behalf. Confidence because this was the order of things passed down from Moses, a forefather of the Jewish faith who received these instructions directly from God. You see, it was all part of the Levitical system they knew so well and understood so clearly. They were comforted by the tradition passed down through Moses, the comfort of security in the familiar. There's great comfort in the familiar, isn't there? Like certainty in what we can see. But remember, as we learned last week, that the author of Hebrews is making the case that there is greater certainty in Jesus. Certainty about who he is, the exact imprint of the nature of God, where he came from, where he is now, and the authority that he holds and the salvation that is only offered through him. And yet it was the comfort of the old, the familiar of the priestly mediation on their behalf of what they all knew that the writer of Hebrews is placing his focus on in our text today. So would you turn with me now to our text today? We will be in Hebrews chapter 4, starting in verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer sacrifices and gifts for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So also, Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said, 'You are my son. Today I have begotten you.' As he says also in another place, 'You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek.' In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek." Now, there's a lot packed in these verses, but I want to start with a question for each of you this morning. What keeps you from drawing near to God? You know, maybe it's insecurity as the result of an ongoing sin. Maybe it's a choice based on some bad interactions that you've had with so-called Christians. I mean, you've said to yourself, if that's what it means to follow God, I don't want any part of that two-faced stuff. Maybe because it's of a fear that you may have that what he may ask of you. Maybe you simply don't know how to approach him and are too embarrassed to ask for help. Maybe you're the skeptic in the room, an agnostic stance, belief that there is a God, but he's super distant and there's this massive gap between you and God. Maybe you lived life on the edge for God and now you're on autopilot because you served your time, secure in what you have already done for him, because you feel like it's time for someone else to step up. Or maybe lying deep in your heart is this pain, a pain because God let you down, because he screwed up. What is it for you this morning? You see, regardless, this is what the author knows to be true, that the world doesn't stop in its pursuit of wanting you to rely on the broken system, the incomplete system of self, to make God out to be a distant God, a vengeful and wrath-filled God, an unloving, unapproachable God. And this is what the author is calling out this morning. He's saying these are the exact reasons why we should draw near to Jesus, because of what only he can offer. And the author uses the art of contrasting the Old Testament priesthood to Jesus to drive home the point. So now that we know what the high priest looked like, let's learn two other pieces of context: how the priest was selected and the role they played. And it's taken a lot from Exodus 28. So let's look again at our text, starting in chapter 5, verse 1. It says, "For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins." And then jump down to verse 4. "And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was." You see, two words jump off the text: chosen and divinely selected. You see, first, there was a requirement was that they had to be a descendant that came from a direct line from the tribe of the Levites. Exodus describes the high priest as the one who is the greatest from amongst his brethren. And this greatness was represented with a reverent awe of God, also known as piety, with wisdom, handsomeness, and strength. Though the ideal candidate for high priest had all these qualities, the two most important qualities were always wisdom and always piety. And lastly, they had to have this deep sense of humility and feeling not worthy of the role to stand in solidarity with humanity, acting on the behalf of men. And there are documented attempts of others not respecting these duties, only reserved for the priest, and they were always met with catastrophic judgment. Take a look at number 16 in the story of Korah and 250 followers who were swallowed up by the earth because they tried to take over a priest's role. Take a look at Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 13, where he tried to assume Samuel's function as priest and ends up losing his kingship. Take a look at Uzziah, who used a priestly censer, and he broke out in leprosy in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. And you see, the Jews knew that it were stories like these that caused them to have such a trembling fear of approaching God and his throne, which was seen as a throne of judgment and wrath. So what about their role? You see, the priest was their mediator to God and was looked on with such favor because of what only he could do for them. You see, there was a continual ongoing payment of a debt that needed to be reconciled. Something needed to absorb God's wrath because of the sins of the people. And it needed to be continual because there was a lot of disobedience then. And I think we can agree that there is a lot of disobedience now. Without going off on a rabbit trail, let me just put it this way. A just and pure God could not have impurity and sin in his presence. And so this debt had to be reconciled because God, who is pure and clean, cannot have anything that is less than perfect and pure dwell in his presence. and remember that at that time, God was dwelling in the midst of their uncleanliness inside the Holy of Holies in the temple. And you see, the priests had to make sacrifices for God's people to be the debt of sin. And those payments were made through the shedding of blood. There was lists of them. Goats and sheep and birds were among the acceptable animals to be sacrificed. And we all know the animal that Pastor Derek would have tried bringing to the altar as well as high priest. So I couldn't pass it up. I mean, read Leviticus and see the amount of sacrificing that went on. Spoiler alert, Sarah is going to really unpack the significance of sacrifice in a couple weeks from now. So I'm just going to touch on it briefly here. Just know it was continual and it was bloody. And their role is clearly seen in Leviticus 16 as it describes the Day of Atonement. You see, the day was established by God to restore the pure relationship between God and his people, to be cleansed from all their sins. And there was a strict process to follow. You see, the priest had to kill a bull for his own sins first, because he dare not atone for the people's sins before he did it for his own sin, because of the impurity that came with him. Then the priest had to lay his hand on the head of the sacrifice, representing a transfer of the sin to the animal so that it could be accepted as a viable sin offering. He had to do this first and enter in the Holy of Holies, which he only entered one time a year on this Day of Atonement. And then after that, he would go back out and then offer another sacrifice for the people. And he did all of this from a heart of empathy and sympathy. Take a look at verses 2 and 3 on chapter 5 in Hebrews. And it says this: "He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people." You see, there was the awareness that he had of his own sinful nature, that he was weak intellectually, physically, and emotionally compared to God. It's why he could deal gently with them. And it's this system that the audience of Hebrews were so familiar with, that the author was highlighting and saying, no other tradition and system more foreshadows the future greater atonement of Israel's Messiah, our Lord Jesus Christ. It provides a perfect backdrop for us to see the vast superiority of Jesus' atonement over that of the high priest's atonement, because God's wrath was absorbed once and for all with Jesus. This is why the author is saying, let us then with confidence draw near. You see, he's saying this morning, draw near, because, it gets us to our first point, because Jesus is the ultimate two for one. You see, not only is Jesus the high priest, he's also the sacrifice. Look at verse 5 in chapter 5. "So also, Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.'" Would you underline that and in the margins write, "Jesus is the ultimate two for one"? Here's why. First, he was appointed priest by God. You see, verse 5 is a prophecy verse that is taken directly from Psalms chapter 2, verse 7, that points to Jesus. Not only do we see it in Psalms, but we also hear God say something very similar when Jesus is baptized as he begins his ministry. In Mark chapter 1, verse 11, it reads, "And a voice came from heaven and said, 'You are my beloved son. With you, I am well pleased.'" You see, God declares, "I chose Jesus and appointed him for this role." And it mirrors the way in which the priests were appointed in the Old Testament, as we just mentioned. And so if he was appointed high priest, then we know from just studying what the Old Testament said that his role as priest required him to make sacrifices to God on behalf of the people. Now remember that the Old Testament law required continual and repeated sacrifices because of the continual sin of the people. Jesus' sacrifice, however, was the ultimate and perfect sacrifice offered for sin. But why? What made his the ultimate and perfect sacrifice? You see, the key is in the comparison to the Old Testament sacrifices. The Old Testament sacrifices are but shadows of the real sacrifice of Christ on the cross because of the high priest's continued sinfulness. You see, God's wrath is always proportionate to human sinfulness. And an imperfect high priest cannot offer a true sacrifice, just as the blood of bulls and goats could never truly pay for the offense of human sin or substitute for the shedding of human blood. And as a result, the payment of debt remained. But not so with Jesus. He takes the list of your offenses, the number of times you've gossiped, the number of clicks on that website, the lists of the lies, the totals of the deceit, the number of hits you've taken, the number of pills you've abused, the number of empty bottles with your name on it, the number of times you went selfish with pride, the list of times you took rather than gave, the receipt of all the wrongs you still hold on to, poisoned in bitterness. Let's be honest. We're not talking about a list on a couple sheets of paper. We're talking about boxes full of ways in which you failed God. You failed yourself in repeated sin. And Jesus takes the summary report of all these grievances against God, his Father, and he looks over it for what seems like an eternity. And then he opens the drawer and pulls out a stamp and slams it down on the list of your sin. And he slides it back over to you, and it reads in big, bold, red letters, "Paid in full." And it doesn't make sense, does it? Our shame and our guilt for what we do continues to condemn us and tells us we are not worthy. But Jesus says, "Stop it! Stop it!" And I still can't help myself. When I go to God, it's not... God's not saying, "Oh gosh, not Scott, you're going to have to pay for this a little bit." No, you see, when Jesus goes to the Father for me, he holds up the finished product. And he says, "God the Father, you can no longer punish Scott because it would be unfair and unjust because you've already punished me for that. You just owe him love. You owe him grace. You owe him mercy." So now, when you go before God, there is no threat of judgment anymore. Because you see, Jesus lived the perfect sinless life, as it says in Hebrews 4, verse 15. He was without sin. And someone this morning needs to hear this. Needs to hear this. Why are you keeping your distance from him? Stop allowing your current circumstance to influence your view of God. Rather, allow the truths of God, the truths of Jesus, to influence how you view your circumstances. You see, he knows what's best for you. And the only reason why you can't see that is because of the distance you are choosing to keep between you and his throne. And this passage says, draw near, because he is not only the greater high priest, but also the perfect sacrifice. And if that's not enough for you, that's okay, there's more. Which brings me to my second point. Jesus gets you. You see, Jesus relates to us with sympathy and understanding. Sound familiar? Listen, I have no idea what your story is, the battle you are facing, the struggle around the corner, the fights that are coming, or the storm on the horizon, all the ways in which the world has beat you down. You know, maybe you're overwhelmed with despair, crippled by anxiety, lonely, ravaged and torn apart by a relationship mess. Maybe your mantra is, "I don't ever feel like I'm going to get over this or beat it." Maybe when you feel control slipping away, you get crazy angry and leave a path of destruction in your wake. Maybe you're struggling in faith. You've got questions that you just can't seem to find an answer to. Maybe you've reached the pinnacle in your career and you're left feeling like, "I thought this was going to be better than what it is." Maybe you're sitting here thinking, "True, you don't know what I'm going through, nor do you understand the temptation that I constantly face. But do you know who fully understands? Jesus." And this is where you laugh, that cynical laugh, and say, "How could Jesus fully understand temptation? Wasn't he God? How could he have experienced every individual temptation? He wasn't a woman, he wasn't old, and he certainly wasn't married." I'm not saying that he experienced every temptation, nor am I saying that he experienced the temptations that come from repeated sin, but he did experience the essential temptation that supersedes whatever we may experience. You see, C.S. Lewis puts it this way: "Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. After all, you find strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in. You find out the strength of a wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. A man who gives into temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try to fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the fullest what temptation means. You see, Jesus experienced a sustained depth and pain of temptation that we will never know because he didn't sin. You see, Jesus never caved. No human being will ever experience temptation to the extent he did. Doesn't this help this morning? Think about it this way. When you go through pain and you're talking to someone, isn't it helpful and comforting to know that the person you are talking with has gone through it and felt it as well? Isn't there a sense of comfort in that? Knowing that I am talking with a God who has felt it for himself, who knows firsthand what temptation is like, what being hungry is like, knows what it's like to feel betrayed by family, to be stabbed in the back, to know what it's like to be single. You see, he knew disappointment. How many times did we hear him say, "How long must I be with this crooked generation?" You see, he knew the grief even of a child rejecting him in Peter. You want more? Look at the last night on earth in the garden and the anguish he went through. You think that is the physical and emotional reaction to someone who isn't being tormented to the extreme? He sweated blood. He cried. He lamented to God. "God, if there is another way, show me." He did it three separate times that night, and he heard the same thing. "There is no other way, son. You have to suffer." And he stared down that fact that he had to suffer, and he remained obedient. Why? Because he saw you. And his death was the once and for all moment, the debt of sin paid in full forever. And the best part about the entire story is this: he beat death. And because of that, he continually sits at the right hand of God, which is good news. And it leads to our third reason why we should draw near, and it's this: Jesus gives you an all-access pass. To understand this last reason, we have to retrace the steps of the temple that the Hebrews would have known so well. You see, we're going to start out and step up on to the temple and walk through the court of the Gentiles. Going up the steps to the temple, we come to the first entrance, the court of women. Yet to the Gentiles, it says, "No trespassing." You walk through that court to the other side and come to the bronze gate, and it says to all the women, "No trespassing." The men proceed into a small, very crowded court, the court of the Israelites, until you reach a knee-high wall, and it says to all the men, "No trespassing unless you are a priest." The priest can pass until he reaches the sanctuary, the holy place, where at the door it says, "No trespassing unless you have been chosen to burn incense." Then, of course, there is the very inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, where its curtain shouts, "No trespassing unless you are the high priest," and that only once a year and under very strict conditions can you then dare enter. But not with Jesus. You see, Jesus continually brings us near to God. Look at verse 14. It says, "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God." Stop right there and underline "passed through the heavens" and write "all access pass." Gang, look at the symbolism here. Jesus passes through the heavens. It mirrors the priest entering into the most holy of holies. But remember, that was only done once a year. But do you see the difference with Jesus? He passes through the heavens and he doesn't leave. He's constantly in the presence of God, seated at his right hand. It's why when Jesus died, the veil that separated the Holy of Holies was torn completely in two from top to bottom. You can see it in Luke 23, verse 45. You see, no longer do we have a need of a temple or a special priesthood to stand between us and God. And listen, I think it's important here to recognize that some of you have come from other faith backgrounds where this idea of an earthly special priesthood exists. You know, as a guy who was raised Catholic, I held fast to this idea of the importance of a priest who I was told could be the bridge between me and Jesus, even to the point of forgiving or retaining of my sins. But our text today is clear. There is no need for the old system. Not an imam, not a Catholic priest, not a Buddhist priest, not even Judas priest can provide direct access. Why? Because we have a great high priest in heaven, and his name is Jesus. As it says in 1 Timothy 2, verse 5, there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. What don't you see in that verse? Right, the need for someone to go to God on your behalf other than Jesus, which means that you don't need me, you don't need Pastor Derek or Pastor John or Pastor Mal or anyone else. You have direct access, just like I do and just like they do. We are nothing special. He's available to you all the time. And that is the essence of verse 16 when it says, draw near to the throne. You see, it's in present tense, and that is so important to note because it's emphasizing that the privilege to draw near is always available. Think about all the times Jesus modeled this approachability and availability. How often he would say while he was on earth, come. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Let the little children come to me. Come to me, all you who are labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And in Revelation, and the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let him who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price. Take a look at this comparison table. On the left is a summary of the role of the priest. On the right is how Jesus' role compares. You see, Jesus is saying to each of you this morning, there is no comparison. I mean, let's just do it this way. Would you put a giant greater than sign in between those two columns that points toward Jesus? Seriously, do it. Cement it, declare it, because there is no denying who he is. And the crazy thing is that he did all of this for you. He says, whatever you lack, whatever you need, whatever has kept you at a distance, he says, come. Don't you see the no trespassing sign has been torn down, and in its place stands a sign that simply reads, come. Yes, you. I'm talking to you, the woman who is broken, the guy that is covered in shame and guilt, the addict, the depressed, the skeptic, you who feels that there is such a distance between you and him. He says, come. Come, woman who stands in the outer courts, ridden with guilt and shame, whose husband has abandoned her. You go straight in. Come, recovering addict who seems to stumble more than he stands. You go straight in. Come, you who are shrouded in deep bitterness and resentment toward God. It's time to put that down and find healing for your soul. You go straight in. Come, faithful servant of mine. There is still work to be done. Don't sit back just because you have had a place within the inner walls as a result of serving for some time. Those eyes you have are haughty. Go straight in and receive your next assignment. Come, you who has been peeking over the walls with curiosity. What are you waiting for? The invitation is open. Stop wavering. Go straight in and receive the victory in which you were always meant for. And he says, come with boldness. Draw near with confidence. And you know why? Because he's the two for one. Because he gets you. And because in Jesus, you have the all access pass to the mighty throne of grace and mercy. What a priest. And so my next step for each of you is simple this morning. Would you simply draw near to God, to go to him now during our time of reflection, or maybe later today, or before you go to bed, or even in the next 24 hours? Haven't you kept him at a distance long enough? So I want to set up this moment of reflection much in the same way that we started, with a description. So I'm going to ask that you put all your things away. And whatever it looks like for you, would you put yourself in a posture of meditation and reflection? Quiet your soul. Close your eyes and just invite and allow God to flood your mind and illuminate your heart. You see, because there comes a day. There comes a day when you will see him. Can you even begin to fathom that? A day seen by Daniel, Isaiah, and the prophets of long ago. The scene too majestic for words, not worthy of the limits of my mind, and yet an undeniable and inescapable truth, there will come a day. A day where the Alpha and Omega, God Almighty, righteous and holy, his clothing a gleaming white like the sun's reflection off the snow, He sits on his throne, engulfed in flames of purifying fire. There the judge sits, book opened, an endless sea of servants before him, his court assembled for that day, a day for you and me, a sentence awaiting each of us. And then from the right comes forward the greatest of all the priests. His name is faithful and true, accompanied by the clouds of heaven themselves, sitting upon an all-powerful white steed, the fiercest of horses you have ever seen. At the sight, your soul shudders. You drop to your knees, for no human strength can withstand his greatness. You see, his eyes are like the flaming fire, electrified with flashes of lightning at the center, a roaring inferno. A jeweled crown adorns his head, brilliant stone of all colors, emitting from them a kaleidoscope of beauty never seen. His body, clothed in the purest of white robes, radiant and flowing, the ends of the garment dripping with blood, blood stained for you, for me. And across his mighty chest reads the word of God. And behind him, the fiercest collection of warriors, an endless army, all adorned in the most brilliant of white, armed with the greatest of weapons, sitting atop their mighty steeds, the snorts from their breath rising up and collecting together like an approaching storm. And from his mouth, he draws the sword of truth. And a silent hush rushes over the army. Shivers run up and down your body. Your soul cannot catch its breath. The time has come. You see, God's story is about to be complete, because on this priest's thigh a name is written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he shatters the silence with these words, "Behold, I am coming soon, and I will make all things new." What a sight he will be. What a sight he will be indeed.